Hi there, I'm Greg from Kapow. Visit us at kapow.com to check out our unique collection of everyday reusable products designed to help you do more with less. CUPPOW.com.
Hey, what's up? This is Jack Inslee, host of Full Service Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this show, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Estoy buscando un algo que me dé sombra,
que baile bomba, que me responda.
Estoy buscando un algo que me dé sombra,
que baile bomba, que baile el yuba.
Estoy buscando un algo que me dé sombra.
Ay, porque el que tengo calor a mí me da.
right. That was just Bumbayo, who will be in studio live later on. My name is Greg Bresnitz. I'm one half your host for Snacky Tunes. Today is all about Puerto Rico. We have the founder of the Puerto Rico Meets NYC Fest, along with some chefs and mixologists in studio today. Do you want to go around the room and announce yourselves and say where you're from?
Sure. Marie Elena Martinez. I am the founder of Meets New York City.
What's up, guys? My name's Nolo. I'm the founder of Mofongo NY.
Hi, guys. My name is Pedro Alvarez from Alcor Foods in Puerto Rico, processing plant of sausage, traditional sausage, longaniza.
Hi, and my name is Lynette Marrero. I'm a New Yorker from Brooklyn. I am your mixologist today, shaking up some rum cocktails.
So before we get into the festival, I think it'd be really great to kind of set the stage of traditionally, like, what is Puerto Rican food? Like, let's say in the 80s and before, if I were to go down there, what would I expect to have expected to find?
Before that years, you know, what you can find is very, very traditional food, but we prepare it at home. You know, and what is called the fondas, the arroz, habichuela, really the traditional foods of the island, the mofongo. So that's what's really all about, going out to eating. But then after, we have a markup in the history, like Alfredo Ayala. We consider him like the grandfathers of the modern Puerto Rican cuisine in Puerto Rico. So finishing the 70s, starting the 80s, you know, this is where this chef start to add new techniques to the Puerto Rican food, but preserving the tradition and the flavors, you know, and he started to evolve a new experience with the food. So,
and so before he started updating that, like, what would my great-great-grandmother have made for me? What would I expected on the table?
Yeah, I think Manolo can talk to you about that, because Manolo, I mean, have a very, very deep roots.
I mean, I wasn't born before the 80s, yeah. You know, but I can't comment on that, because where I'm from, I was telling Pedro earlier, I'm from the countryside of the island, mm-hmm. some would call it. So, and it's really centered on family and all the joy of just celebrating life and what our tradition is. So my grandma, you would see her doing fricassés, you would do asopao. So it's all these soups that were just like really dear to your soul, and it just brings back all these memories. And it's all everything we found was all the local livestock, everything that they were in the fields just grabbing themselves. So it's more about where you're from and your surroundings, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. and mm-hmm. what you got from there, because back in the day they didn't have as much reach to get ingredients from different parts of the island. You had to actually just succumb to what you had in your backyard. Mm-hmm. So it's more about what you had in your backyard, and, you know, sharing it with your family and making something out of nothing.
So what were some of the dishes and flavor profiles that you grew up with?
Well, I grew up with mofongo, which is what I make, and I brought it here to New York.
Which is delicious.
Yeah, and it's really simple. We get that from our African heritage. It's back in the day, it was called fufu. And basically, Africans, when they came over here, they were given scraps. So what they would do is they would grind up spices, any root vegetables that you can find, and then all that, whatever, slave food, all that, like, necessity food is actually what redefine what our food is nowadays. You know, now you have a lot of really amazing chefs just putting a modern twist and mixing it up with French influences, with Asian influences, but it always goes back to the same thing. And I think that's the part of it, you know, keeping that culture, keeping that heritage, and honoring what we had in the past. That's what Puerto Rican food is about.
And was the food, when they didn't have much reach, would it be like the same dishes throughout the year, or was there a certain seasonality to the dishes?
Yeah, this we eat a lot of pork during the whole year, but especially in Christmas season is where you're going to find these beautiful family parties where we do the whole roasted lechon, mm-hmm. you know, and we're starting to see the arroz con gandules with the guineitos en escabeche, la ensalada de papa de la mamá. So we're starting to see, especially in the Christmas season, this kind of dishes, you know.
And Pedro, I know that you went to Italy.
Yes.
What did you learn there that, you know, you brought back with you that wasn't, you know, potentially found in Puerto Rican cuisine?
Well, over there, when I arrive, I run basically all the stations in the different restaurants that I work in. And so I learn a lot of technique, you know, using, well, the French the fresh ingredients. So that's what I brought back to Puerto Rico. A part of the northern Italian cuisine and all the flavors and the dishes, you know, I came back to Puerto Rico and apply that techniques in with the Puerto Rican flavors. For example, one dish that I can tell you is we have a lot of fun with the dish. We call it the cabrioli. So we make the ravioli with the cabro, so it's goat stew inside, you know, with this sofrito flavors, just, you know, and beer.
Somehow that didn't make it back into the studio.
It's a lot of time and preparation.
Yeah, I can understand. And then as it's been updated through the 70s and 80s and 90s and into this, like, what is emerging, or like, what is new to the cuisine and the, what is the new tradition?
Well, I can tell you that there is this period after Alfredo Ayala, as I told you, start to become creative with the Puerto Rican cuisine, you know, and then we starting to receive a lot of influence, like modern, like came Asian, Latino, you know, and different influence. But now what is happening, you know, that we realize, this generation realized that our traditional food is already full of flavor. You know, this generation, which I belong, you know, travel a lot. You know, I went to Europe. I have a lot of friends that came to the United States, South America, different areas, even Asia. You know, and we agree when we come back that the Puerto Rican food is real tasty. You know, we put a lot of effort in the flavor. So we have a great product, and we are mostly focusing on that, you know, to make sure that we do our traditional food good, you know, make it taste good. And this is the advantage that I can say we have in this moment.
I feel that to add to what Pedro says, which is completely true, that my generation is going back to its roots. And we were talking about this the other night, where we're going back to the fields. We're going back to our roots of buying, you know, produce from Los Placeros, and just going back and that connection where you had, you know, from the field straight to your kitchen, instead of just, you know, all this processed stuff that's going in. And we're more aware of that. So I think with Puerto Rican food right now, other than all the advances and all the light that's been shining up on us, we're taking it back to what it usually is. So if you see us any weekend at Smorgasburg or any other events, we're mashing mofongo with wooden mortars. Mm-hmm. And we're doing it in a single one. I'm talking about every order is mashed to order. Basically, where we can, any other person who just wants to make money off of it and can push 500, 600 orders, we would get some sort of machine to do it for you.
Right.
But I want that connection.
And has the agriculture and farming business in Puerto Rico kind of kept up or adapted, like, you know, in the States, you know, it went to big ag, and now there's obviously been a rise to local farms and work, you know, chefs and restaurants, you know, getting farmers to plant special crops or grow special breeds. Have they fallen in step with you, or is, you know, where is that in relation to the new movement?
Yeah, in Puerto Rico, that is what's happening right now, and it's like the wave already come, and it's getting bigger every day. You know, as I tell you, this generation realized that, you know, if we want to bring ahead the economy of the island and get it stronger, you know, we recognize, after being like for years, most of the products came from outside Puerto Rico, and the agriculture was very affected. But now you see young guys, you know, they come out from the university,
yep,
and maybe they have degrees in something else, but they coming back to the land, to work the land, you know. And the chef, at the same time, we are very aware of that, and that's what we're doing, ties to make this happen, you know. And we have special pieces of land that is producing what the chef asked for. You know, I need to grow this for my restaurant. You know, these guys are, they are more than willing to do this kind of work to move their product with the restaurants.
And where do you see the Puerto Rican food movement sitting in like the current like economic state of Puerto Rico and like, you know, shifting the focus? Or like, do you see it as like a driver to helping it get back to where it needs to be? Or what role do you see food playing?
Definitely, it's fundamental. Yeah. You know, it's a very strong column of the economy because that's bring. First, we start to eating better, you know, we start to getting, I say, healthier, you know, and this is what we transmit to the people, and it's in different ways, it works with the agricultural area in the restaurant. At the same time, that's what we're doing here, shouting very loud what we are doing in the island, so people as well come to visit us to try this food and try what we are doing, you know. So this is another economic area that get healthier as well.
I just wanted to add that all of my chefs that came in for Puerto Rico Meets New York all were so adamant about the ingredients that they brought. This one doesn't want the morcilla here. This one doesn't want the beef from this. This one doesn't want this kind of churrasco. This one doesn't want this kind of mangoes. And they brought so much ingredient with them because they're proud of what is actually being made there. Instead of always importing, they are growing. All of these chefs have plots of land, as Pedro was saying, and they brought it here, and you saw it over the dinners, over our events. I mean, really, really home-cooked and homegrown ingredient.
And what is the background for PR Meets NYC? Where did the idea come
from?
Sure.
So Meets New York City was a brand that was born last year with Baja Meets New York. Basically, I felt that I travel a lot. My background is as a travel writer and food writer. And I was always welcomed into people's homes, no matter what the language was, by food. I mean, every table was always a welcome table. And I think that it's really hard for armchair travelers or for people who don't travel as much to really understand how important food is in the larger world, both as a connector and both as a talking point in everyone's lives. So I thought that I live in the most amazing culinary city in the world with so many of these chefs that have come through here before and worked with many of these other guys. Let's see if we can bring them in and do mashup dinners where we can showcase what these destinations are doing. So Meets New York focuses on a destination, takes the time to really research the chefs that are doing interesting things there, pairs them with New York City chefs, brings them here to have a culinary spotlight on tourism.
Okay, well, we're going to take a quick musical break. We're going to come back, we're going to talk about rum, and we're going to talk about some of the dishes that you might find, and then some of the hopes and aspirations of what you want to convey to people through the festival. Up first, we have a song from Conveyor, who is on Snacky Tunes Live Volume 3. Stay tuned.
Something I wish I'd ever told you, hurrying back to 212. You're thinking about those greenish colored eyes are on the first of every wet and humbled head ashamed of love. I'm serious, man, I can't stop feeling. Going out naked, nature thin. Coming on home to sand and water, lamb and slaughter. First at holiday time and making pie. Something I wish I'd ever told you is flying on planes, I'd like to hold you. And nerves like never justified the feeling inside the first of many old worries. And it's worth it to me to skate around the bad times and all the little feelings get tucked away at bedtimes. Tuck it. Thank you.
break someone's heart? And how do I dare not take it apart? Cause thumbs and knuckles all are white with innocence, bite the first of typical sign of dark night. What do I say if taking my time means rushing all the wrong things? I'd rather you take my mane and deal with the bucking and fucking up again, because it's worth it to me to skate around the bad times. All the little feelings get tucked away at bedtime.
All right, welcome back. So the one thing we haven't touched on yet are the drinks of Puerto Rico. And I would have to say that rum is probably the most prevalent of alcohols there. I'm not a big rum drinker until I went to Puerto Rico for the first time, and then I realized I just never really had the right rum. So tell me about what kind of preparation goes into making cocktails for a Puerto Rican event, and you know, some of the things that you're looking for in a good rum.
Absolutely. And as touching on what our two chefs were talking about, the very first instance I ever saw of rum drinks is in the most famous book. And my mother has this book that's tattered. It's Comida Criollo, and it's like the Puerto Rican food Bible. And it's been translated into English for all of us first generation born here. and in the back, there's all these cocktails that go with the food. And it's rum centric. And it's these wonderful cocktails that remind you of these home parties when you guys were talking about Christmas and the lechon and the holiday time, and then when your mother makes the coquito, and there's this like whole process and this pride of giving away these beautiful drinks that you create. And rum is the center of that. You know, sugarcane and obviously the Caribbean is that center for where rum is from. And I, because rum is one of those ingredients that really expresses where it's from, you know, it can be made in so many different countries, in so many places. And James Beard said it's the most romantic of all the spirits in your closet. And I truly believe that, because there's something about rum and the mystique. And when you look at the range of the rums in the Puerto Rico portfolio, you know, they are the drink. So you have the lighter crystal rums that are much, you know, that you have in the coconut daiquiri, which is light and fresh, and you're sitting on an island and you want a coconut because it's rehydrating, or you want something really robust that really shows the intense aging, like the Barolitos, and those that are really aged because it happens so quickly in the humidity and the intensity of the heat and the sun of the islands. But you get all those whiskey flavors and notes, and that's where you really start. And I think just going back to what you find, you know, my grandmother would have a passion fruit tree in her backyard, and you just grab those passion fruits and squeeze them and have those just with rum, and you, it just be a part of your culture. And that's really where it comes from, is that accessibility to these wonderful fruits and ingredients that you have. And that's where I love that it's food and culture and seasoning and flavor, and that really is the soul of Puerto Rican people. I feel like that word sazon is our word to really own and embrace, and that comes through in the different culinary aspects, whether food or spirits.
So when you guys are looking to make dishes to pair with rum, like what type of flavor profiles are you going to play up to pair the two together?
Well, for example, we do a lot of rum glazes for meat, you know, and then we combine maybe with a little honey, and we make this rum and honey reduction that goes to glaze a meat. So that's the way, one example of the way we use it in the kitchen. For example, we can marinate as well with the melao, the meat, and that's our ingredients that have to do with the rum, you know, that is an application.
Yeah. So, Marie, so one of the things that was really great is that you paired Puerto Rican chefs with American chefs, and like what went into the the pairing of the two, and you know, what did you have any guidelines or restrictions on like what type of meals they had to produce?
I think what's most important when you pair chefs is that there's rapport. I think when you take anyone back in a kitchen, you have to really know your way around. You have to have kind of this camaraderie and also like a creative similarity where one doesn't think the other is totally and completely out there. In the case of Puerto Rico, so many of these chefs have kind of sued with other New York chefs. So it was easy, and many of the pairings are guys who have worked together in kitchens before. Juan Jose Cuevas and Chef Didier Elena worked together at Elaine Ducasse, and Eric Rupert and Jose Santaella at Le Bernardin. So that was very easy. But in the case of someone like Pedro Alvarez, who hadn't worked with anyone here, I tried to figure out who here was of heritage. And J.J. Johnson is also kind of this young, really interesting, creative guy, and I thought that they would riff well together. They had never met each other, and I went into that kitchen the other night after dinner, and it was just a love fest. It was one of those things where if you take the personalities, take what you know of their foods, and really line that up, you usually have a quite successful matchup.
That's great. Well, I want to make sure I get an answer from you on this last, from all of you on the last question, but given the growth of Puerto Rican food and the exposure and the explosion of it, what is the one thing that you really want people to understand about the cuisine or the drinks or the chefs or the country that, you know, if they could take one lesson with them, what would you like to impart on them?
I would like to say that it's not just rice and beans.
Okay. Fair enough.
Another thing is that people. I have a lot of questions. If it's spicy, they ask me, is spicy Puerto Rican food is spicy? I say no. We have our food is got a lot of ingredients that is a very depth on flavors, and then in the house every table there is a bottle of pique on the table. So then if you want it spicy, you will add the pique, and everybody is very proud of their own pique that they make in the house, you know. This is my pique. No, this is my pique, you know.
Who makes it the best?
Well, in my house, actually, my father is the one that made the pique, so I respect that my father's pique is the top one.
Is the recipe passed down, or is it like a deathbed type of scenario?
No, it passed down, okay. You know, we make it together, but he's always in charge to make it in the house.
Okay.
I'll talk a little bit in depth of this question because that's part of my goal here in New York. I was born and raised in Puerto Rico, and I moved out here, and I think when we started this, we obviously wanted people to understand more about our culture and more about who we were through food. As things progress in the island, I hear a lot of people talking negativity about the island, and there are so many positive things happening. There are so many beautiful things happening, so much growth in certain areas, right, that are not being highlighted. And that's what I want to do with my 10x10 food stand here in New York. And if I can get somebody to pay attention to what's really happening in the island and to see, like, pass through, like, all the negativity that's happening, and they see that we're happy people, we're loving people, we put effort into what we do, we bleed this, you know, and we're proud about what we do. That's what I want people to take back, you know? There's a lot of things with the food, but that's what I want people to know. There's so much more than what you just hear and read.
And I'll give a shout out to La Factoria, which is the top cocktail bar in Puerto Rico. And the bartenders there work really hard. They literally have been creating on an island and sheltered away from the world. And they have gone out to search and to be part of the global cocktail community. And this week they're being honored in 50 best bars in London. And I'm going to be able to be there at that event and see, you know, my home country take home an award, something that's been really hard earned. And they're expressing their rums, and they're so proud of everything, and they're hard workers. And I think that's really what's great, is that there is this island that wants to be a part of the global community and is really working, though, internally to be the best they can be and be hard work and then present that to the world. And I would say, you know, being the child of immigrant parents who moved moved here to Brooklyn to have a better life for me and my sisters. And it's about that hard work, that passion, that go-getting. There's a mentality of intense work that is indigenous to Puerto Rican people. And I see that through the food and the culture and the drink and just a very proud community.
That's amazing. Well, I want to thank you all for taking time off from the festival, which is actually happening right now in Roberta Street here in the background. So I'm going to cut you all loose because I know that you have people to serve. So thank you for making time.
Thank you so much.
We have Bumbayo up live in studio next, but first off, a song from Lucius, who was in studio a couple years ago live on Snacky Tunes.
Bye.
meet you.
All right, welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We have Bombayo live in studio. Welcome. Would you like to introduce yourselves?
Hi, I'm Melinda. I'm co-founder of Bombayo, Melinda Gonzalez.
And I'm Jose Ortiz, a.k.a. Dr. Drum.
So for the people who don't know, what is Bomba Music?
Well, Bomba Music is a music and dance and singing form. It's an artistic expression from Puerto Rico. It was derived from the enslaved Africans that arrived and were taken to Puerto Rico. And, you know, while on the surface it looks like a entertainment and it is a lot of fun to dance, you know, it has a really strong cultural root and tells of the history of Puerto Rico that's oftentimes not spoken about in history books.
Yeah, also, to add on to that, we're talking about a music that is a hybrid of culture on the island. And so there itself, there's a process there. So we could know that the bomba already, there's a fusion, right? But then when it came to the island, it became a particular language, a tradition. And so, you know, when we talk about the bomba we're doing, Puerto Rico has become the cradle of that music.
And it was a traditional music. How was it passed down, or how did people learn the styles and the rhythm and the music?
Well, the development of bomba started at least, 300 years ago. So this was the, sugar plantation era in Puerto Rico. And essentially, in terms of the format, there's drumming. There's a dancer that dances to the drum, and the drummer marks the dancer's movements. In traditional African dances and other dances, it's usually the opposite, where the dancer is following the drummer. In this case, it's the opposite. And so the families all throughout the sugar plantations, and these are, enslaved people living in really dire circumstances, kept this going throughout the generations. In this, last century, it became more of, performances and, a sort of tourist and audience-centered situation where the stage was introduced. And now, there's more groups that have formed to pass on the tradition.
I think it's very important to understand that when we talk about who started this or who's responsible for passing it on, that's really... there's not one specific answer, but there's one that is obvious that we have known for a long time, and we have to really give credit to the Cepedas. This is one of the oldest generations in Puerto Rico that goes over four generations, right? So we're talking, when we say over four generations, you were talking about at least over 400 years of this music. And then you have the Ayalas, the Aduens, the Negrons. And as we get to learn more about this culture, because right now as we're talking about bomba, we are still learning about it. So it's an open book, and each day it's like finding a treasure. We find something, we learn something new that's really older than what we already know.
Right.
Right? So this is still an ongoing process, and I think that, but the bottom line for us, what does bomba really talk to us as an identity when we're talking about Puerto Ricans, that are music that really originated from the African diaspora, which is what's important for us to understand, that this is important because... one thing that is very dominating in this culture is our Spanish roots. But when we're talking about the African roots, this part of it has been suppressed, marginalized. And so this is a big story and that we need to really understand that why bomba is behind and not forward and present in our culture as Puerto Ricans, having a consensus of that understanding.
And around the 70s, it almost died out. Why did that happen? Or how, after 300 years, that time period, you started to almost lose this tradition?
You're talking about the industrialization of Puerto Rico. And in that case, around in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, Puerto Rico experienced a large, massive migration to New York City and other parts of the country. In fact, you know, they were coming to work in places like Williamsburg and Red Hook and all throughout the Brooklyn waterfront communities to work as low-wage labor. And so, you know, you're taking, much like in the process of slavery and then taking, you know, all of your talent and resources and human resources, you know, in slavery it was taken from Africa and, like, millions of people were gone, you know, vanished, and it sort of decimates the population. Traditions disappear and change, and so you have this sort of void and vacancy of people just up and leaving the island, you know, looking for work, and sort of the family structure even gets changed and rearranged around.
One of the things that I want to touch on is you mentioned that, like, you introduced it to tourism. The stage was also, like, brought into the tradition. What was it before? Before it was more tourism. Was it just mostly for families or communities? Was it a way of keeping tradition alive? Or what role did it play before it was, like, a tourist angle?
Well, again, when we talk about certain families that we could really give credit to in reference to a tradition that's passed on from generation to generation. How many people we know personally that we know that have done that as a family? I'm not talking about, like, maybe one person in your family doing bomba and the rest of them are not doing. We're talking right. about as a whole family, right? Right? There's only a handful. Mm-hmm. There's really only a handful. I'm doing bomba, but I'm the only one in my family doing right. it, right? So, and that's now that I did not grow up with it, and so I'm not the only one with this problem. And I state it as a problem because it's a disconnection from your own culture, not understanding what, you know, bomba as an identity and just looking at it as an entertainment, as a music style, right? So there are very few families, and again, and I mentioned those, you know, when we talk about the Cepedas, the Aduens, the Nadas, the Negrons, these are the very few families that probably passed it on to generation to generation. Right.
And how did you come to bomba? If you didn't grow up with it, how did you get into the tradition?
That happened. It was an accident. it was an accident. I was giving a workshop on congas, and I had a workshop that was called the Gospel of the Masacote back in 2001, and I was in a union building and doing a workshop, and then a group of people came in, and I remember this particular person. It was Roberto Cepeda and Tito Cepeda as they're walking in, and they were doing a plena workshop. And I didn't know what plena was. So at the time, Tito Cepeda, who passed away now, asked me to borrow my congas to do this presentation. I sat in to watch. And as they were talking about it, they were talking about this music and that it's from Puerto Rico. And me being Puerto Rican and never been at Puerto Rico. So it was after 40 years of my life that I first went to Puerto Rico. That's wow. That's how disconnected
right.
I was from my own culture. And so during this workshop, I said, wow, I need to know more. And so right immediately after that, there was a advertisement. Hugo Asensio, who also passed away, was giving a workshop on plena. And I went to that workshop, and that's how I got into the bomba.
It's amazing.
So interesting.
It's a very specific setup and a very specific protocol. Can you walk us through the instruments and then how, since it's radio, how the setup would be if you were to watch it?
Well, there are two principal drums, right? When you look at it, you may see 5, 10, 20. Out of the 20, 19 will be a buleador drum that plays the bass rhythm. And again, when I say the bass rhythm, is that in bomba, our rhythms have names, so it's not just one particular rhythm that is played. The rhythms are, you know, they do have a definition that talks about the dance and the style. So, for example, if we're going to be doing a rhythm called sika, right? So, Mike, give me a sika, right? Just... And that's the buleador drum. Now, I may come in with the other drum that's called the primo, but usually the primo, keep playing, because, beautiful. When a dancer comes out to dance, this other drum is communicating with the dancer, and it's the dancer that's making the drum talk. So I'm responding, this other drum called the primo will respond to a particular movement that comes from the dancer. Saw that, right?
Yeah. So for people who aren't in here, the one of the dancers moving her skirt, and the drummer's in response to the movement of the skirt.
So that other drum came
so
into
the body, could be
the
shoulders, the elbows,
the hips. Is there a different place on the drum you play depending on where the body is moving from? Do the shoulders and the hips feet. Have a different? And the feet have different places or different rhythms?
Well, this is where not different rhythm. The drummer, the primo, will interpret it. With a particular sound. I may use a snap tone, I may use an open tone, I may use a bell tone, right? And again, that's by discretion of the drummer. I may do a snap, the other drummer may do an open tone, right? Each drummer has a certain way of how they're going to interpret that particular movement. But again, it's directed by the dancer.
I can see a very important relationship between the dancer and the drummer that could take years to develop. Is that part of the culture? Just the,
well, I want to. We do have we have a dancer here who has a good strong background in dancing, and I would like to have her input on that. Yasma Cruz, you know, I would like to for you to please have some input on this.
Hi.
Okay. Well, one of the beauties of Bomba, which is what you just saw, that the dancer communicates with the drummer. It doesn't necessarily have to be many years to develop that. It's part of the dance already. As soon as you step into that bate, as we call it, you salute the drum. You say hi to the drum, to whoever is doing that, to whoever is playing that primo. And from there, you take it on. You might not necessarily know who's, we call subiendo on the drum, but that relationship is established since the beginning, since the very first beginning. And I would like to add something very important. You asked why it was, maybe it wasn't there, the presence of the bomba wasn't there many years ago. This is a culture and a dance that has been persecuted, suppressed. So for us doing this many years ago, you get beaten, you get killed. Like, there were people who could not step into a bomba dancing. If you were from another part of the island, if you maybe were doing plena, if you were doing something else, you could get cut. I've known people, because I've interviewed people who have shown me scars. This is from a bomba dance.
And where does the violence, where does it originate from?
It's not that the violence is originated from there. It's just that this was the only space that the slave had to communicate, to feel that they were humans. This, it was usually on Sundays. That was their free day. And as the masters start to realize, they will use, like, we use Spanish, but we sing many songs that are not in Spanish. We don't even know exactly what they mean, because it was a combination. We're not having people coming from one part of Africa. We're having people coming from different countries, right? We're having people in Puerto Rico already. So all the mix, this is the common language, the music, the song, and the dance. So all the words that could maybe appear similar, that's what they were using. And they will play a bomba in a part of the island, and that will carry a message over another place. So they were communicating. And as soon as they realized that, they were like, we need to stop this. We need to cut any form that they have of getting together, because maybe it's a threat for them.
We've talked about a lot of the popularity of Puerto Rico and the resurgence, both in the food and the music. You had mentioned earlier there are some negative potential effects of the rise of popularity of bomba. What are some of those?
What are
some of the negative side effects, or do you see anything negative?
Well, I think that, you know, going back to piggyback on what Yasmin was talking about, when we're talking about a particular era, and it's hard to, when we're talking about the bomba today, that's why I say there's not one story. You cannot just relate it to one story, because then we're going to lose we're not going to get the picture of what we're doing today, because what we're doing today does not reflect on, let's say, when we're dancing today, we're not dancing with that same emotion that you're, let's say, you're going to lose your life or you can't do bomba. Today, you can do bomba.
Right.
So it's a different emotion. It's a different expression in the dance. That's not the same dance. It's not coming from that. But what we have to talk about is that why today, when we're still when we're looking at Bomba, why is it still a problem? Because it originated from that time and era that what she's talking about. That when we're talking about in Puerto Rico, you have to understand that right before 1873, there was slavery. Mm-hmm. So we have to understand that who, that this was the group from 1873 and back behind that, that was the group that was doing Bomba. It was not the Españoles on the island that were doing the Bombas, right? So this is a very important conversation that this is why we still have to sit at the table and understand what that means, because there are different eras in Bomba. And if we identify the eras, we can now see that from this era, this is what happened. Now, we're today we're doing this Bomba. It's not what they're saying, because you got people dancing who don't care about that story, who don't care about that history. This is what the problem is, and this is where we tie it into Black Lives Matters, right? This is an issue, and Bomba is really one of the music, out of all the styles of music, that elevates our consciousness, that really reminds us of what that means. And so Bomba is important for us for that reason.
I want to add a little bit more to that, too. Is that historically in the United States, about 5% of all of the Africans that were brought to the United States. And all throughout the Caribbean, South America, Central America, you talk about 95% or the majority of people, of Africans were brought to those regions too. So sometimes we tend to like, you know, regionalize things or, you know, just by geography and political lines. But when we look at a broader, what we call African diaspora, you know, that reaches all the way from Canada, the United States, the Caribbean, South, Central America, and South America. That's a family. That's a cultural identity. And when we look at Bomba and we look at other traditions similar to Belé in Guadeloupe, I mean, in Martinique, and Guoca in Guadeloupe, those traditions are very similar to Bomba. And but you can go down the all the coasts, you know, into Colombia and Brazil, and so many traditions that are African-based that, you know, you feel a sense of familiarity to it. You know that this is connected in a really, really strong way. Jazz, you know, there's a foundational element, there's an improvisational element to most of this music, and, you know, that's the strong connection. So I think when we think of a Black Lives Matter, you know, we may consider it like a movement within the United States, but in reality, it's a really movement within the African diaspora to give ourselves value and to tell people that these things need to be valued and not marginalized, whether they're Black lives. Black lives is connected to Black music, Black food, all these traditions that come from an origin of slavery, of Africanness. You know, it's time now. Before, there was the Civil Rights Movement, and that didn't actually exist in Latin America. There were no Civil Rights Movement. There wasn't any that, you know, there was a push. But this right now has momentum, and, you know, I think it's important, like Jose said, to connect, you know, the connectivity and intersectionality of these things. They're not in packaged in a box. And I think when you talk about the negative effects, one of those could be, you know, commercializing or popularizing things. Like, we know salsa to be has been sort of packaged and then sent out to the world. And I think that's one of our concerns, is that, you know, somebody wants to, you know, huge record companies or, you know, industries want to sort of package and see Bomba as something to popularize and commercialize, and we understand it, you know, to be such a strong part of our cultural identity. And we, you know, we definitely don't want that. We want more people to know about it, certainly.
You can't separate the music from the past.
Right.
I understand. Well, I want to make sure that we have time for a song and to let you do what you're going to do. So you're going to close us out on a song. But I will first want to thank all our guests today for PR Meets NYC. I can't wait to go out there and eat the food and see the dancing and the music. Thank you for everyone for listening today. Hello to my family. Hello to Ornella. And we'll be back next week with another episode of Snacky Tunes. Is there a name for the final song, or what are you going to take us out on?
Yeah, No Me Quiere A Mi.
Okay, thank you. Here we go, Bombayo live on Snacky Tunes.
program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.